1942, freshly humiliated from the attack on Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt demanded a show of strength against the Japanese. Jimmy Doolittle, a stunt pilot with a doctorate from MIT, came forward and led 80 young men on a seemingly impossible mission across the Pacific. Dubbed the Doolittle Raiders, they struck the mainland of Japan and permanently turned the tide of the war in the Pacific. But their legendary mission wasn't the end of the story. In his debut history, Last Mission to Tokyo, the extraordinary story of the Doolittle Raiders and their final fight for justice, legal scholar and historian Michel Paradis uncovers one of the last untold stories of a seminal moment in World War II, the pair of trials in Shanghai that determined the future of legal and military history. With incredible and gripping detail, he recounts the dramatic aftermath of the Doolittle mission, which involved two lost crews captured, tried, and tortured at the hands of the Japanese, the dramatic rescue of the survivors in the last weeks of the conflict, and the international manhunt and trial led by two dynamic and opposing young lawyers, Major Robert Dwyer, a prosecutor determined to bring justice to the raiders, and Lieutenant Colonel Edmund Bodine, assigned to defend the Japanese, who were forced to confront the questions of what constitutes a fair trial, when we should show mercy to our enemies, and right and wrong, in the fog of war. The result is a heart-stopping, perspective-shifting courtroom drama that opens our eyes to a final act in the story of the greatest generation. Like compelling World War II histories such as Lucky 666 and Nuremberg, Infamy on Trial, Last Mission to Tokyo is a thrilling war story meets courtroom drama that also offers a deep dive into the Japanese perspective that fans of Clint Eastwood's Letters from Iwo Jima will find fascinating. Welcome, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. We're very proud to have with us today Michel Paradis, the author of Last Mission to Tokyo, and it's one of those books you absolutely can't put down. There was a whole lot more to Doolittle's raid than most people are aware of, and he has really unlocked a huge drama here, and it's going to capture your attention all the way through and encourage you to get the book Last Mission to Tokyo. Michel Paradis is a leading scholar and lawyer of international law and human rights. He has won high-profile cases in courts around the globe and worked for more than a decade with the U.S. Department of Defense Military Commission's Defense Organization, which led many of the landmark court cases to arise out of Guantanamo Bay. He also holds the position of lecturer at Columbia Law School, where he teaches on the military, the Constitution, and the law of war. He has appeared on or written for NPR, MSNBC, The New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Foreign Policy, Lawfare, America, The Intercept, and the late Weekly Standard. He lives with his wife, daughters, and Yorkie in Manhattan. Michel Paradis, how are you doing today?
After that introduction, I'm doing great. Thank you.
It's great to have you with us.
My pleasure. My pleasure entirely.
Please give our fans a little bit of your background and tell our listeners just how you came across this story.
Sure. So I've been a lawyer for approaching 20 years, which is astounding to think about. And much of my legal practice over that time has been war crimes trials. And so I've done war crimes cases in Africa, to some extent in Europe, even Central America. And one of the projects I've spent a lot of time on was the Guantanamo Bay cases, which are war crimes prosecutions that have been conducted since the Bush administration. And so I was working in 2007 in the Bush administration, and there had been an ongoing debate over whether or not waterboarding constituted torture. And we had heard a rumor that there was a case in which we had prosecuted the Japanese for waterboarding. And so that was obviously of a lot of interest to determine what international law had to say on these things. And so we sent a young Marine captain to the National Archives to fetch this old record of trial, which I don't know that had been seen in 70 years at that point. And I remember one rainy day actually cracking it open and looking, and it was the trial of the Japanese who were being held responsible for murdering and torturing the Doolittle Raiders. And it just totally stunned me. And I realized not only was it not just a case about waterboarding, it was a case about so many other fascinating issues, how we treat our enemies in wartime, what is justice under international law, the American virtues of truth, justice in the American way, shaping what the post-war peace, right? This is 1945, 1945. 46, what the post-war peace would look like from then on out. And so it just stunned me. It was such an amazing story, even on the dry transcript that I was reading, that it stuck with me. And eventually, I got around into making it a book.
Well, you've done quite a job. The book reads extremely well, and it really does, no matter which perspective you come from, it does raise a lot of questions. And I'll have a few of those questions for you as we go through. For our listeners' sake, what is the story behind the Doolittle Raid?
Sure. So, you know, it's one of the most famous episodes from World War II, probably one of the most heroic and almost insane at first appearance missions that the Americans engaged on. It's April 1942. World War II is at that point something of a disaster for the United States. Germany is on the march throughout Europe. Our campaign in Africa is not going well. The Japanese have spread their perimeter all around the Pacific. They're bombing Australia. They've taken our largest colony in the Philippines. The Bataan Death March is underway, in which tens of thousands of Americans are tortured, abused, and killed. And it looks like the United States might just lose this war. And Roosevelt had been railing his generals for months, saying we need to have a counterattack. We need to show some sign of a fight, of force, of success. And ultimately, the person who gets to have to do that is a guy named Jimmy Doolittle, who is a stunt pilot who had rejoined the Army in 1941 as a lieutenant colonel and was asked to do the impossible, right? In 1942, it's simply impossible to fly a plane over Japan because of Japan's incredible defensive perimeter. It's just technologically not something a bomber could do. But Jimmy Doolittle engineers around the problem. He applies American, you know, ingenuity and stick-to-itiveness to figure that they can take off 16 mid-sized army bombers, B-25Bs, off an aircraft carrier. And if they can get close enough to Japan, they can fly a one-way mission over Japan, do a bombing run to show the Japanese they're not as invulnerable as they believe, and ultimately, hopefully, get to safety by landing in China. And he pulls it off. That's the most, it's the most amazing moment of the first in the first few moments of the war. The idea that America is capable of striking back, right? It is so galvanizing.
That did so much for American morale, and it did a lot to inform the Japanese that they had something to worry about.
Absolutely, right? It shows that the United States is not only in it to win this war because it's the right thing to do, but it's something that the Americans can do, right? We can win this war. It completely screws up the Japanese sense of invulnerability. They end up taking some disastrous strategic decisions, not the least of which was hastening the Battle of Midway, which becomes, you know, it's Waterloo, so to speak. Pardon the mixing of war metaphors there. But it also redeploys its air power around the Pacific back to the mainland to prevent further attacks. It engages in just an utterly brutal operation against China that's completely strategically useless. They attempt to basically prevent further efforts to land in China, and so they destroy every airfield in China, completely destabilizes what had been relatively successful pacification operations up to that point in 1942. And Japan never has any meaningful control over China after that. So,
what kind of damage did the Tokyo bombing do?
Pretty light damage. The planes were all equipped with demolition bombs and then an incendiary cluster. The demolition bombs were actually pretty accurate. The Japanese Self-Defense Forces, some scholars associated with it, did a report about 20 years ago analyzing the Doolittle Raid. And the demolition bombing was actually pretty successful in targeting things like the Mitsubishi factory, things like other factories, some oil refineries. The incendiary bombing was a little less accurate, but that's, I think, just because incendiary bombs just are not accurate, and so ended up spreading fire in a lot of residential areas. But the bombing itself was fairly accurate, but that's not to say it was significant.
It can be praised, though, right? Because these planes had to fly super low in order to avoid anti-aircraft fire. Instead of being able to drop bombs from anywhere between 10 and 20,000 feet, they had to drop them from what, 1,500?
500.
500.
They ended up going, yeah, so sorry, they did their approach at 500 feet, and then to drop went up to 1,500 feet. So, right, it's like driving, you know, at one point in the book, I describe it like driving through a town you've never been in at 200 miles an hour.
Yeah, trying to recognize the street names.
And trying to figure out where you're going.
Because these guys were given maps that were taken from a surveillance plane.
The training was
good, and to do the job that they did, I think, took incredible nerve and steadiness on their part.
Absolutely. And practice and skill, because that's sort of one of the things that there's this, you know, certainly in the first half of the 20th century, you know, there was the Howard Hughes impression of what a pilot was, right? These guys who kind of just rode planes like horses. But Jimmy Doolittle was unique, almost uniquely capable of doing something like the Doolittle raid, because he had a PhD from MIT. He would do these things that seemed completely insane, right? One of his most famous exploits was a blind flying exercise where he took off from an airfield in Long Island, flew 14 miles overhead, and landed without ever being able to see a foot in front of him.
Did he paint the windshield, or was it?
He had these like panels that he put over the windshield, and it was, you know, to some extent seemed crazy, but his whole point was, when you're up in an airplane, everything is different, right? You're flying blind anyway. You need to rely on instruments. You need to rely on mathematics and precision, because if you're relying on your gut, you're going to get spun around and turned upside down super fast. And so he was just that kind of guy. He's an incredible American. He really should have, he should be much more of a household name today than I think he is.
I remember the first time up in a small plane with my sister as pilot, and I was kind of shocked. I said, "Sis, we can't look through the window and see the runway. What's going on here? How are you going to manage this thing?" So, yeah, it's a weird feeling. And back then, I mean, they were only just a few decades away from really the invention of the plane. So,
yeah, it's the iPhone of the era, right? It's this completely new invention that is completely changing society. And people are still learning how it works. One of Doolittle's other exploits, which I think is, I mean, in reflecting back on its impact at the time, it's difficult to understate how significant it was, is he was the first American to ever fly across the country in 24 hours. Now, that today seems, you know, oh my God, a 24-hour flight across the country seems horrible, right? How many connections would you have to do to have something like that happen, you know, to get from Boston to Los Angeles? But this is a time when, you know, trains only went 70 miles an hour. You know, he really did, in a way, knit together that single feat, kind of knitted together the United States as one place, right? All of a sudden, Los Angeles was as close to Boston as Boston was to New Haven, Connecticut. And that's a real just change in, you know, our sense of ourselves, actually, as a country, right?
Jimmy Doolittle and the telegraph.
That's right, Jimmy Doolittle and the telegraph. That's right. Those two inventions, those two things, really did just knit this country together as one place. And so it's just, you know, I as you can probably tell, I'm just fascinated by Jimmy Doolittle. I think he's just this great, extraordinary human being who, as I said, I'm surprised is not more of a household name.
He sure gave us a lot of hope in 1942. That was a scary time, and I think a lot of youngsters studying history today really don't quite understand that the United States did not know how a war on two fronts was going to turn out, and it was not looking good in 42.
No.
And you explained that very well earlier.
Yeah.
So the 16 planes, how many were able to get out successfully and how many were captured?
So not a single plane was shot down. Japan is taken completely by surprise. Jimmy Doolittle's strategy of doing low-level bombing to avoid anti-aircraft fire works and then some. The anti-aircraft fire ends up doing more damage to Tokyo than to any of the planes. All the planes make it out of Japanese airspace, but only one lands on its wheels. That one lands at York, basically is running very low on fuel and turns north and lands in Russia, which is very controversial politically at the time for reasons I'm happy to explain. But all the rest of the planes are hunting around for this homing beacon that Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the force that's allied with the United States in China, is supposedly set up. But none of them can find it, actually, because it's not there. And so what ends up happening is the other 15 planes all crash. Either the crews jump out and let the planes crash into the mountains, but at least in two cases, they actually ride the plane all the way down and crash into the East China Sea. What's miraculous, though, is all but two of the crews, so I guess that's, what, 13 of the 15 who crash land into China, make it to safety within less than a month. They make it to Free China. And so, you know, when Jimmy Doolittle comes home a month after the Doolittle raid, when all the secrecy, right, there's all the secrecy about, you know, what was the Doolittle raid, who pulled it off, FDR tells his press secretary, say the planes must have left from Shangri-La to misdirect the Japanese. So when Doolittle comes back and it's revealed that he was the one who did it and that nearly all the crews survived, all the men survived, it's just this just incredible moment, right? The fireworks are going off. It's this, you know, the United States can finally take some comfort in that through kind of, again, American grit and ingenuity, we were able to do what everyone at the time thought was impossible, to take the fight directly to Japan.
We'll return to our show right after this message from our sponsors.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
And now, back to our show.
But two of the crews, as you probably guessed, don't make it out. Two of the men ultimately die in one of those plane crashes off the East China Sea that I talked about. But then the eight crew members, five from one plane, three from the one that crashes into the sea, get captured by the Japanese in China. And that's really the jumping off point for my book, is this, you know, what happens to those who can't make it out safely.
And describe what happened to those prisoners and how long they were incarcerated, how that path went for them.
It did not go well. They were all rounded up, taken prisoner, put into the custody of the Japanese Kempei Tai, which is this kind of secret police clandestine service that the Japanese army is running. All of them are tortured incredibly brutally. Waterboarding is part of that, but also things like stress positions, being hung by the hands, being subjected to prolonged sleep deprivation, solitary confinement. One of the men who I write about, Chase Nielsen, they actually take these thin sticks that Nielsen describes as looking like thin pencils, and they pin his hand to a table and then jam the sticks into the webbing of his fingers, down into the finger nerves. And he described that as probably one of the worst sensations he had ever felt in his entire life. It just got right down into the nerves, right? These are sadists who had practiced the art of torture and were more than willing to use it.
It seems that they enjoyed their role, because the information that these downed pilots could have given them was limited. All they knew was that they were sent on a mission to bomb Tokyo. They bombed Tokyo. They crash-landed in China, period. That's all they knew.
Yeah.
So for years, they're being held and tortured in Japanese holding cells.
Yeah. Yeah, they're being tortured in Japanese custody. And in fact, they didn't even know the mission was to attack Japan until they were 2 days out at sea. They all rendezvoused. They did a lot of training where, you know, they clearly were going to be doing something unique, because they had to figure out how to get a plane up in 500 feet. But they rendezvoused
off a deck.
Off the deck, right? But they don't say off the deck; they just say 500 feet.
Off a deck, pitching in high seas.
That's right. And so they rendezvous in Alameda, California, get on, see their planes loaded onto an aircraft carrier, and then it's only 2 days when they're out at sea that the captain of the ship breaks in and says, "This task force is bound for Tokyo," and that's the first time they actually find out what their mission is. So it's a really incredible, you know, the incredible act of bravery and duty, you know, to go into something that's, you know, is dangerous. That's the only thing they're told, that this is going to be a dangerous mission. But to commit to something that, you know, I think in their honest moments, they probably understood might be, you know, the last thing they ever do. You know, it's an incredibly dangerous thing they did.
Explain what function Major Ray Nichols had in Operation Magpie.
Yeah. So Ray Nichols is an interesting character all by himself. He's the head of an Office of Strategic Services commando team that had been fighting the Japanese in the Burmese jungle throughout much of 1944, 1945, but then gets tasked a few days after the bombs drop on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that the OSS's new mission is going to be rescuing American prisoners of war all around China. And Nichols is put in charge of a team that's tasked with getting a prisoner of war camp, liberating a prisoner of war camp on the outskirts of Beijing called Fengtai. And he and his team fly over, drop down in the early evening. You know, this is on 2 days after the emperor has surrendered. And they think, okay, we're in a truce. But sure enough, some pops start going off from the...
Yeah, somebody hadn't made the phone call.
Someone hadn't gotten the memo. That's right. So they take some fire. A Japanese lieutenant kind of rushes out. Basically rescues them from this field and explains, you know, had you guys dropped a couple hours later, you would have definitely been killed because the enlisted don't know, right? They didn't get the memo. The enlisted don't know that the war is over. And it's only the officers who've been told. But through his negotiating skills with the warden of the Fengtai prison, he ultimately liberates 500 Americans and Europeans who are being held as prisoners of war there. They have this massive victory party in a hotel that Nichols repurposes as their barrack. That was in Beijing. Yeah, the Grand Hotel des Wagons Lits, which was an old geisha house that they repurposed into their bachelor's officer's quarters for liberated prisoners of war. But while this victory party is going on, Nichols hears a rumor that the Doolittle Raiders were being held at Fengtai. And no one believes that, right? Because the Doolittle Raiders, by this point, are all believed to have been killed, right? The eight who are captured were all believed to be killed back in 1943. But he nevertheless gets in the face of the prison warden at Fengtai. And within a few hours, the warden brings out some three very emaciated Americans who had been just freshly shaved and buzz-cutted. And Nichols goes up to one, a sort of soft-spoken Utahn by the name of Chase Nielsen, and asks him who he is. And he says, I'm Chase Nielsen. I was a Doolittle Raider. And Nichols kind of gets this wry smile and says, look out for this guy. He's off his rocker. Because it's, you know, it's Lazarus back from the dead.
Yep. Unbelievable. And then he gets the rest of the story. He finds out that there's one guy still barely alive. I think he was on his last breath when Nichols got there, right?
Yeah, George Barr, was an orphan from Brooklyn who had taken on the Doolittle Raid, actually, you know, had his birthday on the USS Hornet before the mission and, you know, is near death. One of the other Doolittle Raiders who was captured, a guy named Robert Mader from Ohio, he had already died of starvation. Three of the Doolittle Raiders are executed in October of 1942. And that's what everyone believes actually happens to all the Doolittle Raiders. But the five who are not executed are held in secret prisons, essentially, subject to what the Japanese called special treatment. And one of them, you know, dies of malnutrition in the December of 1943. George Barr is on the verge, literally on the verge of dying in August of 1945. And but for the grace of God and Ray Nichols, would have. Probably within a few weeks, but is ultimately rescued and taken into a hospital in Beijing.
Who was Ham Young?
So Ham Young is, again, another, certainly not someone who's a household name. He was, you know, one of the leading lights of the military legal profession in the 1940s. He was the founder of the Judge Advocate General School, which ultimately establishes itself in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He sort of sets out, you know, he's a serious guy. He sets out, he's written books on constitutional law. He's a career military lawyer at a time when military law is only kind of law, right? It's the old joke used to be that military law is to law what military music is to music. And Ham Young really just sets out to change all that, to make the legal profession a much more serious enterprise within the military, to make law a serious enterprise in the military. And he happens to be stationed as the top lawyer in China for General Wedemeyer at the end of the war. And the Doolittle Raiders, after they're rescued by Ray Nichols, the three Doolittle Raiders who are healthy enough to travel, get brought to Ham Yong's headquarters in Chongqing, China. And Ham Yong sits them down and basically says, what happened? And he asks, because at that very time, the United States has decided as a matter of policy to conduct war crimes trials of the captured Nazi and Japanese war criminals, which is itself kind of a radical innovation that comes from the end of the World War. It was not uncommon throughout history to just execute your enemies.
Round them up and kill them. Forget the trial.
Absolutely. Don't bother with the trial. And that wasn't even kind of a hypothetical. At the Tehran conference, where Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin meet for the first time, Churchill described Stalin as having proposed over dinner, why don't we just make a list of the top 50,000 Nazis and execute them? And Roosevelt is reported to have sort of jokingly replied, well, what about 49,000? Wouldn't that be sufficient as a matter of humanity?
So he ends up taking 1,500 of their top scientists and splits them with Russia.
That's true too.
And brings them over to one of our Air Force bases in Ohio, where a lot of secret testing is done. Right.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly true. I'm not going to give you a rosy colored picture of either World War II or the post-war period. But the idea that anyone would
I've still got it in for Hirohito, and I'm going to talk to you about that in a minute.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We can definitely talk about that.
Do you have any extra bumper stickers that say "Hang Hirohito"? I might be a little late, but
yeah, it might be a little late. You'd have to hang his dead body. Although the British used to do that, they used to try people posthumously for treason, and then hang their corpses after having dug them up.
That's creative.
Yeah, but actually, speaking of the British, Winston Churchill in his memoirs kind of reports, describes recoiling in horror that anything as barbarous as killing 50,000 men without trial would ever be done. But some secret documents, some secret diaries were actually only released in the past couple of years. So that's exactly what he wanted to do as late as 1945. 50,000, the number was probably more in the hundreds than in the thousands. But he was actually opposed to war crimes trials. He thought we should just essentially create hit lists of Nazis and then execute them on site. But FDR was, he pushed for it. This was really an American policy to not only have trials, but, really fair trials. Stalin was comfortable with trials. He had a lot of, let's quote unquote, trials of his own up to that point. But the idea that you'd have fair trials for your enemies was really just, a remarkable innovation that's pretty underappreciated.
So Ham Yong was appointed to set up a war crime office in the China Theater. Is that pretty much what his purview was?
That's right. He sets up the war crimes office in the China Theater and sets up plans to conduct war crimes trials of the Japanese. And so when the Doolittle Raiders come in, it doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to see that this is going to be potentially the most important and significant and publicized war crimes trial of the entire post-war period. Here can we find the Japanese who are responsible for the torture and the murder of the Doolittle Raiders.
So what were the numbers on that? Now, that was set up with an American judge. There were also other trials which were set up with different judges in different areas. One was in Australia. They had an ongoing, I think, trial there in Australia under a different judge.
Yeah. They had lots. All the Allied powers, to one degree or another, conducts war crimes trials. Different places too. So the Dutch, for example, conducted a number of war crimes trials in Indonesia. The Australians conduct them in Australia, but also in the South Pacific islands like Ambon. There are a number of trials conducted there.
So what surprised me was that those other trials managed to find 5,000 Japanese military guilty, and of those 5,000, I believe they hung 900. But the American-led trial, if I have this right, only found a couple dozen guilty hung nine?
That can't be right. The United States conducted trials all throughout the Asia-Pacific theater. The Navy conducted them. Army did most of them in China, around Hong Kong, around Shanghai. A number were conducted in Japan. The death sentences certainly would have... So the number of men tried was definitely well within the hundreds across all these trials. I don't know that we got into the thousands. The The Australians had a tendency to conduct mass trials where like 100 people would be on trial at the same time. The Americans resisted that and sort of, and typically only tried about, you know, at most a few dozen at a time.
At one point in your story, it reads, no one reasonably expected Hirohito to be shipped off to Shanghai for trial. And I made a note of that, and I wrote in capital letters, why? How did he differ from Hitler? And then I listed six things just off the top of my mind, which should have, the first of which should have put him on a rope.
Yeah, so, you know, the trial or lack thereof of Hirohito is probably one of the most controversial decisions that MacArthur makes when he's acting as the supreme commander in post-war Japan. I think when I wrote that passage, it was primarily because in addition to the army trials, like the one I read about in Shanghai, there were the international war crimes trials. So like Nuremberg in Germany, there was a counterpart to that in Tokyo called the Tokyo Tribunal, where the United States, Australia, France, the United Kingdom, India, China, and one or two other countries whose names are slipping my mind just right away, Holland, all sort of jointly prosecuted the top, what were called the Class A war criminals in Japan. And that's where, for example, Hideki Tojo is both tried and then executed.
Yamashita got his, Tojo got his.
Tojo got it. Well, Yamashita is tried in one of the individual army ones, like the one I read about. That was a pure American court that was conducted in the Philippines. General Hama, who's responsible for the Bataan Death March, he was tried in the Philippines and executed
And with Yamashita's name, that will segue us to what difficulties did the prosecution face? And please explain the roles and personalities of Dwyer and Hendren, which made a great part of the story.
Oh, great. Thank you. So Robert Dwyer is a fascinating figure. He's this lawyer, the scion of a popular politician in Rochester, New York, goes to Harvard Law School, has a very bright future ahead of him, runs for office on the Republican ticket in 1934, and loses because FDR is just trouncing everybody, right? This is the Democratic wave of the New Deal. And so kind of embitteredly leaves politics, but then becomes a fairly prominent lawyer in Rochester. He's approaching 40 when he gets drafted into the army in World War II, and does some very boring jobs as a weatherman before he gets himself into Ham Young's JAG school in Michigan. Takes the time, takes the chance to take a deployment to China. Is the junior legal officer for the 14th Army, the Flying Tigers. And on one particular day in October, someone hands him a file, a fairly thin file, but a file nevertheless, saying, can you put together the case against the Japanese responsible for murdering and torturing the Doolittle Raiders?
Big job. A lot of digging.
No small job. Yeah, that's right. Because no one really knows who is responsible, right? This kind of that's the real big problem he in particular ends up struggling with. On the one hand, you can say, well, sure, Hirohito, sure, Tojo, sure, but those people are already sort of slated for political reasons to be tried in Tokyo.
Yeah, they've already got files on those guys.
Yeah, but they did a lot of different stuff. The Doolittle Raider was only one of the potential crimes they could have been charged with. But also, it's ultimately a problem where the responsibility is extremely widely shared, right? It goes all the way high up like that, but it also spreads to every guard who handled the Doolittle Raiders, the prison warden who detained them both in Shanghai and then later in Nanking and then later in Beijing.
He found some key witnesses among the friendlier guards, right?
He did. Yeah, he basically is struggling, to figure out who is most responsible for what happened. And, ultimately puts together this picture of what was going on in 1942 in Shanghai and hits upon it almost in this flash of, pure inspiration and genius that the people who are the most responsible are the lawyers, which as a lawyer, I sort of, I set up straight pretty fast.
Yeah, that sounds right.
That's right. Because one of the things that the Japanese don't just execute the Doolittle Raiders. This was a fascinating discovery to me, because you just why didn't they just behead them, right? That's something that the Japanese certainly had done before and certainly did subsequently. But instead, for really, frankly, interesting political reasons that I go into a little bit in the book, the Japanese pass an ex post facto law to put the Doolittle Raiders in front of a show trial. use quote-unquote confessions that had been basically tortured out of the Doolittle Raiders at this show trial, and then sentenced them all to death. And the reason only three are executed is because the emperor decides, as a matter of grace, that he will only execute three, that the rest will have their sentences commuted to this.
You mean that trial came down from the emperor? I thought he wasn't involved.
That's right. That's right. It came personally down from the emperor. It was a compromise reached by Tojo and the head of the Japanese army, a guy named Hajime Sugiyama, who kills himself after surrender and disgrace. And so this show trial that happens, that, you know, both launders this evidence derived from torture, but also is used essentially as the paperwork to murder the Doolittle Raiders. Dwyer sets upon prosecuting the Japanese lawyers and judges who conducted this show trial. And he decides that of all the people who can be held responsible, they're the most responsible. And so that's ultimately how he builds the trial against the Japanese most responsible.
Smart.
For the torture and murder of the Doolittle Raiders. Yeah, it's a brilliant move, right? It's a totally innovative thing to do.
And how about Hendren? Am I pronouncing that right, Hendren?
Yeah, John Hendren. John Hendren is, by everyone I talk to about him, every description I read about him, he's a Democrat, New Deal Democrat politician from Missouri. The most good-looking man anyone had ever met. he was, incredibly poised and reasonable. Not the brightest bulb in the box, but he didn't need to be because he was, so charming. And he essentially works together with Dwyer to build the case, and is, because of his much higher rank and also his poise and his stature, becomes the chief prosecutor of the Japanese lawyers and judges, and the prison warden as well gets prosecuted.
Yeah, and this was like Hendren and Dwyer, kind of like the odd couple.
They really are. That's exactly what I thought of as I was writing him, because Dwyer is this kind of bullheaded Irish. I'm Irish too. I have some Irish in me, so I feel comfortable saying it. This sort of bullheaded Irish, bit of a slob, hot temper, drinks a bit too hard. John Hendren is this, perfect Felix Unger character. Impeccable dresser. Yeah. Yes.
You got to be as an attorney. So.
Well, Dwyer is not implacable. That's sort of the funny thing. Everything I read about him, even including some interviews with people who kind of knew of him, or people that had written about this period and reflected on Dwyer's life, he was anything but implacable. You could turn his face red in 5 seconds if you got him upset.
What did Dwyer learn when he traveled to the Philippines for Yamashita's trial?
So he's struggling to figure out how to hold people responsible, and he goes to watch the Yamashita trial. Yamashita is, one of the more compelling Japanese generals, just in terms of his military brilliance.
Yeah, we did an episode on Yamashita's gold, which he hit.
Oh, yeah, that's a great story.
It's quite a
people
legend.
Still look for it. Yeah, people are still looking for it.
Imelda DeMarcos, I believe, is the one who ended up with the gold.
Oh, really?
She had a fortune. How do you think she could afford all those shoes?
I would be very happy if that was true. I hope that's true. I don't know that it's true, but I hope it's true. That the source of her fortune, her shoe fortune, was Yamashita's gold. But yeah, Yamashita, is a really compelling, really just brilliant tactical commander. Takes over Malaya Peninsula and Singapore from the British at the very beginning of the war, outnumbered 10 to 1. And just through real, again, tactical brilliance, is able to pull off this coup early in the war. He's given the thankless assignment of trying to defend the Philippines a week before MacArthur does his famous return. And he ultimately pulls his men back. They go into the mountains around Manila, but about 20,000 Japanese soldiers, mostly Japanese sailors, stay behind and fight what is unquestionably one of the most brutal, sadistic battles of the entire Second World War. Certainly up there with things like Stalingrad. It's urban fighting of the most just ruthless kind. And the atrocities were rampant. Tens of thousands of Filipinos were murdered and raped and tortured in some of the worst ways you can imagine.
Yeah, they're still not happy with the Japanese today, and there's no reason for them to be.
Absolutely. It's like, children killed in their mother's arms, patients killed in hospitals, people killed in churches. It's just one of the most horrific moments of the Second World War. And it only ends. The Battle of Manila only ends because all the Japanese are dead. And at the end of the war, MacArthur says, we have to find who's responsible for this. And even though Yamashita had retreated back to the mountains, they ultimately devise a legal doctrine called command responsibility that holds Yamashita responsible for it, for the Battle of Manila, even though he didn't direct it. The Supreme Court ultimately upholds this in 1946 over some dissents. There's a lot of anxiety over Yamashita's prosecution, primarily because MacArthur, made no secret of how politicized this prosecution was. It's no accident that Yamashita is found guilty and sentenced to death on December 7th, 1945. And I think, and I would say, incredibly unfortunately, that has led Yamashita to, live in history in a much gauzier light than he should. Because if you go back to Yamashita's career, even though the Battle of Manila, it is not directly layable at his feet, right? He did retreat. He tried to pull his men out, and the men who stayed behind were disobeying orders, sure. But, that famous campaign where he routed the British in Singapore, he committed gross atrocities against patients and hospitals. He murdered about 6,000 to 7,000 Chinese men and boys in Singapore, taking power. He was actually one of the leading fascist generals in the Japanese army. He had initiated certainly sponsored a coup in 1936 that ends up completely destabilizing Japan's democratic government and leads it down this path so that it becomes the sort of imperial, terror state that it does in the early 1940s. It's a real, it's sort of an interesting lesson that when that MacArthur framed a guilty man of the wrong crime, and the sad consequence of that is that we don't remember Yamashita as the villain he genuinely was, that his complexion in history has softened.
Yeah, no, he was totally responsible for the butchery that took place in the Philippines upon the American invasion and prior to the American invasion during the years that they occupied, during the three and a half years that they occupied the Philippines. He was the man. There's a Latin expression for I didn't do it or I'm not responsible for it. I forget what that is.
Latin expression. You
should know that. You're an attorney. You should be popping this stuff.
As an attorney and as a Jesuit-educated young man, I should definitely have been much more up on my Latin. But
nolo contende or something like that.
Yeah, nolo contende. Yeah, that's not a bad one. He has no defense essentially.
We've set up the prosecution with Dwyer and Hendren. Let's set up the defense.
So the defense attorney, the lead defense attorney in the Doolittle case, was almost just as fascinating to write about as Dwyer was, and was sympathetic for many different reasons, but almost equally so. For a war story that's about a trial, I actually found the story utterly heartwarming and inspiring for a lot of reasons I'll get to. But Bodine, Ed Bodine, is a pilot. He is a liaison combat pilot, gets the Silver Star for action against Japan in China in 1945. He's, redeployed to Shanghai in the late 1945 period when, Americans are being sent home by the hundred, if not thousand, each week. It's the great redeployment. There's no reason for him to stay in Shanghai anymore, right? They don't need any more combat pilots. But he has fallen desperately in love with a beautiful Russian woman who is the concierge at the Broadway Mansions, which is the bachelor's officer's quarters that the army takes up in Shanghai. And so he needs a reason to stay, and he needs a good reason to stay. From Russia with love, that's exactly right. And he ultimately gets asked, does he want to be the defense lawyer for the Japanese in the Doolittle trial? And, I think his instinctive answer is no. No one wants this job.
Are you kidding?
Are you kidding? Right. But it gives him a reason to stay. And he had done a little bit of night school. He kind of probably failed out of law school. But he had done a little night school, so he knew a little something. And he takes the job reluctantly, kind of assuming, I think, initially, that his job is to just stand there, right? Be a good-looking potted plant for these guys who are guilty of sin so that they can be executed and it can look as, you know, reasonable as possible for the papers. But what's really just, I found his story actually really inspiring because he decides ultimately that he can't do that, right? That he has to actually give them the defense he would want to be given if he
darn sense of justice always gets
that
in the way.
Darn, right, that darn golden rule. Everyone always gets bitten by that, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So he just commits to putting on the best defense that he can, even though he's grossly unqualified to be doing what he's doing. And really, I think, can be credited in some ways with ensuring that the trial of, you know, what becomes really the trial of a trial, the trial of the Doolittle Raiders trial,
mm-hmm.
Is itself a fair trial, right? It's everything that the Japanese trial of the Doolittle Raiders was not. I kind of just found the whole story, the whole interaction between Dwyer and Bodine, who outside the courtroom are actually bosom buddies, good drinking buddies. And Dwyer is actually in love with Bodine's girlfriend as well.
great.
Right. There's a lot of dynamics going on. But, you know, that these two guys have really just clear, passionate visions of what's right and wrong. And they're both right. You can make it, you know, a good argument for both of them being right. And they just, in a good faith way, fight it out in a courtroom, right? They care about the truth. They care about justice. They care about, you know, all the things that we used to call the American way of life. I don't know. So that, for that reason, I actually found it to be this really inspiring study of heroism of all sorts of different kinds, and people really, you know, fighting for what they believe in, fighting for what's good and true and just, and trying to make the world a better place as a result.
Yeah, you give us all a glimpse of the best of human nature.
And the worst. There's plenty of the worst in there, too.
Yeah. John Grisham gave you a great review. Last Mission to Tokyo is a thoroughly compelling true story of legal intrigue in the most unexpected of settings. Impeccably researched and beautifully written, it captures the reader with the first sentence, and never lets go.
Thank you. Yeah, that was really flattering that he said that. I John Grisham was probably the first author of real books that I ever read when I was a young man. So it was really heartwarming to see that he liked the book.
Well, he's a great writer. Should we tell our listeners how this trial ended up?
So the without getting into spoilers, I know that's always tricky when talking about history. The verdict surprised everybody. I think that's fair to say. Although I will say this, Tojo, this is not a spoiler, Tojo is hung. Tojo is hung in part for his role in the torture and murder of the Doolittle Raiders. That's one of the charges against him on which he is found guilty at the Tokyo Tribunal many, many years later. And so at least one man is hung for what had been done to the Doolittle Raiders. But the verdict of the trial of the trial, which is the centerpiece of this book, it surprised everybody, I'll say that.
Yeah, I think what you could do without giving away too much is tell us maybe three big points that the defense worked on.
Sure. So I think, the defense really ends up trying to, to the extent the prosecution's putting a trial on trial, one of the strategies the defense has to do seizes upon is to try and justify the trial, to defend the trial, right? So we're using the word trial a lot here. But they do that in two ways. One is they try and show that, you know, particularly the general who's being held responsible, a guy named Shigeru Sawada, not only was not directly involved in the show trial, but also was, you know, had actually taken steps to try and stop the death sentences from being imposed. And that was a huge revelation. They also tried to show that the Japanese, and this was really sort of one of the more, you know, jarring but, you know, amazing parts of the story, is that they tried to basically show that the Doolittle Raiders had, in fact, committed some atrocities against the Japanese to try and muddy that water. And
that was
third,
based on their confessions, right?
Yeah, based on their confessions.
Which was forced confessions.
And
yeah, maybe an incendiary bomb missed its target by a few hundred yards.
That's right.
That's so about as bad as it got, right?
Well,
they didn't jump out of their planes and torture 6-year-olds.
No, certainly not. Certainly not. But there were, you know, I mean, but there were, look, there, this is war. And we can't be gauzy-eyed about it. And there were civilians killed in the Doolittle raid. And the question was, were the civilians killed in a way that was lawful under the law of war? Was it collateral damage, like with the incendiary bombs, or could they show something more deliberate? And that's ultimately one of the things that, you know, I don't know is proven to anyone's satisfaction. But certainly one of the most contentious points is, was the Doolittle raid, were the Japanese civilians killed in the Doolittle raid, killed in a way that violated the law of war? Or was it, you know, more like collateral damage? And that ends up being a really contentious point at the trial.
Yes.
And you asked for three, so I'll put a teaser out for a third that I hope won't be a spoiler, because I think, to me, it was one of the more, you know, surprising parts of the book, is that Dwyer and Hendren, in putting together their investigation and putting together the men who are responsible for the show trial, they miss somebody, and they miss somebody big. And that ends up being, I think, pretty consequential at the trial, too.
Ah, good one. Good one.
You know, I think what upsets so many people about justice when it's done right is that there's no tit for tat. You can get a guy who's got a record as long as your arm, who's got all kinds of murders and crimes behind him. But the only thing that matters in the final decision is what happened in relation to this crime that's being tried. And it's the same thing in the war crimes trials, you know. You can't say, well, okay, Japan, without provocation, attacked the United States and for a period of 4 years ignored all international law with regard to captives, committed all kinds of atrocities that went far beyond. I'm sorry, they did. They went far beyond the atrocities committed by the Allies in terms of their barbarousness. And yet we're supposed to give them equal justice under the law. That's the hardest part, I think, for a lot of people to accept.
Yeah, it is. It's incredible. That's why Churchill said we should just shoot him. Yep. You know, it's not the impulse for revenge is as old as time. It's as old as the earliest legal codes. You know, the code of Hammurabi, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And I think what marks, I'll use the word, what marks progress, what marks civilization, is our ability to take that moment at the end of World War II, the United States, and when I say our, to take that moment at the end of World War II to say, you know, we did not just fight this war the way our enemies did, right? We didn't do that. We didn't just fight to win. We didn't fight just for power. We fought for something. We fought for values. And so these ideas that we had in the United States, things like the rule of law, right? The thing that gets so, that's so hard to swallow, right? When our desire for revenge is at its hottest. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that we have to be fair to our enemies, my God, right? It's the most controversial part of the New Testament, or at least it's the hardest part to keep up with.
Yes.
And that we had this moment where we had real, you know, uncontested power over the entire world. We're the only country with a nuclear bomb at that point. And we took that moment not to spike the football, not to, you know, hang the enemy the way, you know, Caesar used to hang the defeated Gauls, like in some great giant parade in square.
Mm-hmm.
We said we fought this war for a reason and we're going to stick to it. The world that's going to come after this war is going to be the world that we take for granted in the United States, with things like the rule of law, with things like equality and justice and fairness and human rights. Like, these are not universal values by any stretch of the imagination.
You're right.
In 1945.
They're not today.
They're barely today. But I can tell you that from 1945 on, they have become part of international law in ways that, you know, would have seemed almost comical, right? Dreamy and idealistic and absurd, utopian in the 1930s. But within, you know, a few years of our winning the Second World War, not only do you have trials like Nuremberg, like the one I write about, where, you know, fairness is extended to enemies, not just revenge, but you have things like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You have things like the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which ban torture, which ban murder, which ban outrages upon human dignity, which treat, you know, and give prisoners of war an entitlement to be treated with dignity and respect. None of that is, you know, is even a glint in anyone's eye in 1940. Yet we take this moment in 1945 to to really remake the world in our best image. And certainly, you know, we're not perfect, of course. We're a country. We're people. No one's perfect.
Well, I think we're a few steps above the Taliban.
But we're like 50 steps above the Taliban. And we're 50 steps above the Germans, right, of 1940. And that's sort of the, and that's one of the lessons, again, I take, you know, there's a lot of cynicism these days, and there's a lot of cynicism about American history these days. And I find that really unfortunate because, you know, we can't learn anything. We can't, you know, set positive goals in our own lives if we don't look back to our history for inspiration.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. It's one of the reasons I podcast history. I try to point out that we tend to see, especially in today's education, we tend to look at things through today's filter and then try and judge what was done 100 years ago or 200 years ago as it applies to today's filter. And it doesn't, folks. You've got to take yourself back to 1672 and to 1865. You just have to take yourself back and look at what was the situation then.
Absolutely. And I think it's not just like, you know, it's not just fair to our ancestors to, you know, give them the respect of their own time, right, to understand them in their own context. It also prevents us from understanding how progress happens, right? Progress comes from a bad place and goes to a better place. And if we look back on our ancestors as all these, you know, oh, well, they didn't live up to our standards of today, you know, well, what's the point of doing anything then? Because we're definitely not going to live up to the standards of people 100 years from now. Not even close, right? They're going to think all sorts of things we did. I don't even know what they are, but I'm sure they're going to be all sorts of things we're doing right now, which are completely unacceptable to people 100 years from now. And I think the only thing that we can do, and honestly, what I think if you an honest reading of history tells us we must do, is to try and just make the world as better than the one we got when we came into it. And that's really what the United States did in the Second World War. It's completely, underappreciated. I know that sounds strange for something as well-trod as the Second World War, but I think how different the world of 1946 was from the world of 1940, it can't be overestimated. And I think it's just foolish. It's naive, it's foolish, it's ignorant to not look at that moment of progress and really just take stock in a way that we should be proud as Americans.
Well, right? I agree. I agree with you very much, and I wish more people would see it that way. I am also tired of the cynicism that I hear. It's very easy to criticize, but you have to have a knowledge of what's going on around the world and what went on in the past and what's going on now in order to appreciate the unique situation the United States is in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a lot of reasons to be proud.
Absolutely. And that's why I love history too. It gives me lessons, and when I'm having difficulty understanding the world I live in today, I always look to history to try and, you know, see it with a cooler eye, which is something that history often affords us. And I think anyone who looks back and studies history with any seriousness, understands no one in the past was perfect, thank God, right? How horrible it would be if we had to live in the world today when our ancestors were saints. it would be complete. That's a standard you could never live up to. But by the same token, it's also, you just see, you know, I mean, things today are so much better. Than they were even 50 years ago, let alone 100 years ago, let alone 200 years ago. And it took people to do that. It took people to stand up for what was right, to make hard calls, to do things they probably didn't want to do. But at the end of the day, you know, did leave us, or we allowed us to be born into a world that was far better, far more peaceful, far more just than anything that they could have even expected in their own lifetimes.
Michel Paradis, thank you so much for this interview. We appreciate it. We appreciate your excellent book, Last Mission to Tokyo. And I encourage our listeners to pick up a copy. It's a fantastic read, and you're going to be amazed at the outcome of this book. And what we just discussed at the end, I think will become a lot clearer to many of you. Michel, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. It was great having you with us at 1001 Heroes.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's a great show, and I'm so proud to be on.
You bet. Thank you.